Welcome to this edition of the Pepperdine People Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Gibson. This series captures some of the outstanding learning and outreach opportunities available here at Pepperdine. Each episode features interviews with exceptional members of our community and the special people who visit our campus.
Thank you for joining us for episode 39 of Pepperdine People. I'm Jerry Rushford, Director of Church Relations at Pepperdine, and I'm joined today by John Whitfleet, who is on our campus to be the 33rd lecturer in a series that started in the school year of 1978-79. The lecture program was known through most of its history as the Staley Lectures for 24 years. For the last seven, this program has been called the Frank Pack Lectures. And our guest today is director of the Calvin Institute of Christian Worship at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and he teaches worship, theology, congregational studies, and music at Calvin College and Calvin Theological Seminary. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Jerry. Happy to be here.
We're glad to have you here on a warm, sunny, gorgeous January the 18th in the year of our Lord, 2011.
About 60 degrees warmer than Grand Rapids.
I was going to say, you're probably happy to be here.
It's a wonderful place to be.
And I should say that we have not flown you here from Michigan. You are here enjoying a sabbatical year and living at Fuller Theological Seminary. How'd you pull that off?
That's right. We're very grateful for the hospitality at Fuller and deep friendships over many years. And we're grateful. Both my wife and I are academics. My wife, a psychologist, teaches at Hope College. And Fuller is a wonderful place with a School of Psychology and a Center for Worship, Theology, and the Arts. So we have a natural home, many friends, and it's a wonderful place for learning and refreshment. And yes, the sun and the warm January temperatures don't hurt either.
And you're here with your entire family. Tell us
That's
who that
right.
is.
Four children. Sheila Grace is 10. Kate, Madeline, Luke, each 8. Triplets.
Triplets.
So we have a very active home life as well.
Right. Now, are you writing a book this year? Or what kind of research are you engaging in?
I typically like to work on a few different projects at the same time, so I'm thrilled to be able to work with several colleagues on a publication related to the Psalms, a musical collection of congregational songs related to each of the 150 Psalms.
Wow.
But I'm also working on a book for worship leaders and those with responsibility for worship in local congregations, a book of practical wisdom. A lot of our work at Calvin is spent listening to local congregations, and this is a good opportunity to harvest some reflections from that work and try to present them in a form that can be of use in local congregational worship ministries.
Now, tell me if you've ever been at Pepperdine before and what brought you here before.
Well, I was thrilled to be here last May for the conference on music, which was wonderful. People from so many places here. And then was grateful to be here last month meeting with people from university church and campus ministries, more informal time of consulting and listening, conversations that are happening on campus. Both were wonderful opportunities. So it's been a great Pepperdine year for me.
And you even drove yesterday with your family to worship at the university church.
That's so right.
You're a part of the community.
That's
now.
Right. The car knows the way here now.
And today you spoke at lunch to about 55 or so people that work at Pepperdine. What did you speak on today?
Theme today was learning wonder. So the process by which we cultivate the habits of wonder, responding to the beauty of the world God has made, and also the beauty of found in human relationships and other places. It's a lost art, really, in many places. Our lives are so busy and often our souls, I think, yearn for the wonder that, in fact, the gifted universe invites us to experience. But it does require cultivating habits that don't come naturally in our world today.
Have you felt well received here?
Very much. Hospitality is terrific.
Did a lot of people come and talk to you after?
There were many wonderful comments and questions. And it's a topic that touches on so many different areas of life, not only church life, but also parenting and family life. It was wonderful to be in conversation with many people.
Now, tonight you're lecturing in Stauffer Chapel, and what are you doing tonight without giving away your whole direction?
Right. Conversation will be about music and the arts in Christian worship. There's a tremendous interest in this topic in many different Christian traditions, but it is an interest that's not often disciplined by the really wonderful work that's been done in academic and other theological settings reflecting on the unique purposes of Christian worship and the way that arts can contribute. So one theme tonight will be the joy of creativity, but another theme tonight will be the importance of discipling that creativity. It takes both sides, I think, for worship to come into its own.
I'm going to spell your last name. You have this beautiful Dutch name, W-I-T-V-L-I-E-T, Witvliet. Is that right?
That's right.
And your wife also had a Dutch name. So you, where did you meet?
We met as undergraduates at Calvin College. We're grateful for the heritage. Calvin is a church-related college and the broad Dutch Reformed tradition, Christian mm-hmm. Reformed Church in particular. So we come by those Dutch names naturally through in the Calvin connection.
Are you and Charlotte both have backgrounds in the Dutch Reformed?
We both grew up as children of pastors in the Christian Reformed Church in mm-hmm. North America, which is one of really several, but small Dutch Reformed denominations.
And then you finished a PhD at Notre Dame.
That's right.
And then did you go right back to teach at...
That is right. The final year of graduate school was actually spent at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. My wife was finishing her PhD in clinical psychology with a residency at the VA hospital.
Wow.
And I enjoyed writing my dissertation in the Duke Library. And so it was
What'd you write your dissertation on?
Dissertation was on the doctrine of the Trinity and the theology and practice of Christian worship.
This was before you had triplets.
Absolutely right. That's right.
So you could write a little deeper dissertation.
That's
now
right. Well, it's a little tongue-in-cheek, but the history of the doctrine of the Trinity can be summed up by, you know, one school of thought which thinks of God as one person with three minds, and one school of thought which thinks of God as three persons unified in perfect community. And by having a single child and then triplets, you sort of have both analogies living at home at the same time.
Right.
So that's a little simplistic, but just enough truth to make it enjoyable.
Now, when I first saw your name, it was in books, and I have several of your books. They all had something to do with worship renewal.
That's right.
Christian worship. So how did this begin? Did you grow up in a home where that was central?
Well, certainly growing up as a pastor's child was important. You see and can sense the love, care, concern that goes into preparing for worship on Sunday. There's an appreciation that comes through that. I also have always loved music and have found music in worship especially compelling. We were blessed to be in congregations with marvelous choirs and organists and pianists and congregational singing. And there is a kind of beauty in congregational singing that I think transcends the beauty of any studio recording. And so I'm grateful for that heritage, and I'm sure that that is a key reason why this field has been important to me.
Now, as a student at Calvin, you established some kind of symposium. Remind me of that. And is that still going?
It is. It is. I'm very grateful for fellow students who joined me in putting on what we thought would be a small workshop in church music one Saturday. And it turned out that first year that rather than just having 20 or 30 people coming, we had something like 125 people show up. And so we continue to do this every year. And it's now in its 24th year and are grateful for the wonderful reception. We typically have 1,500 or more participants. And the last several years, it's become an international event with people from around the world coming.
Now, is that what's called the Institute of Christian Worship?
That's actually called the Calvin Symposium on Worship. And the Institute, which I direct, is a study center, which is both academic and ministry-related. And as a study center, we sponsor publications, academic publications, as well as conference and training events like the symposium. And also, we are grateful to be able to host a grants program with the support of Lilly Endowment that provides funds for congregational worship renewal to roughly 50 congregations per year across North America.
Now, the symposium is an annual event?
It is.
And what month is it?
It is in January, where it is not as warm as it is here at Pepperdine this year.
So you won't be back to direct it this year?
That's right. Wonderful staff, and they will are ready to go with this year's conference.
Now, tell me again, that runs how many days?
It's a three-day event, always the last weekend in January.
And people arrive on what day of the week?
Usually we'll arrive on Wednesday for lectures, worship services, and workshops on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
Okay.
And then they can return home Saturday evening To be back for
so
church.
So they're not
on Sunday.
Missing a Sunday.
That's right.
And how many attended?
It's the last 5 years been over 1,500 people each year.
And who comes? Organists come and professional musicians.
Yeah, our goal is that this is a conference not just for musicians, not just for pastors, but ideally for teams of people from congregations. So it's an event at which a youth director, a congregational elder or board member or leader, whatever they are called in the various traditions, might be equally at home. But we also this year, drawing on the program we established the last few years, we have about 100 high school kids every year who attend. So it's a program that is designed to have enough sessions to strengthen the ministry of those who have full-time work related to worship, but also to engage lay people who have an interest in worship and congregational life.
Now, do you have to be invited or how?
Nope. People can visit our website, calvin.edu/worship, or simply search for the Calvin Worship Symposium. And it's open registration every year. And we certainly have room for more. We're thrilled for, the diversity of types of people, ages, denominational traditions that are represented. Typically about 30 different denominations will be represented in the attendees for any given year.
Now, can people find lodging on the campus? Or?
There are several local hotels that provide inexpensive housing opportunities near campus, and all of that's provided for right on the website. So it makes it very easy for people.
Yeah. Now, when did you start writing books? Did you know early on you were going to write books?
I felt very called to academic work early on. I was grateful for several influential professors and model scholars who inspired me in that way. But my writing has always been a little unique in that I try to work on some very practical ministry resource kind of work, as well as some very significant academic work, usually at the same time. And over the years, I've found that each type of writing informs the other in significant ways. So I've been grateful to work on a very practical book on children and their participation in worship and forming children for participation in worship, as well as work with several colleagues on an academic book on history of worship practices in the medieval and early modern period. And that's grown now into what will be a new book series published by Erdmann's on the history of Christian worship practices. So volumes that will be gathering primary historical documents related to the practice of Christian worship in specific congregations throughout history.
Now, I have different books in my library where you just have a chapter in it. Have you done that more than write monographs? Or
quite a few. Yep, there are two independent solo monographs that I've written at this point, and there are quite a few now, probably 20 or more essays and chapter length projects. Some of those are still essay length because of the pressing administrative work that I also have. Mm-hmm. So many of those are essays that I hope one day will turn into a book, including the themes that we'll talk about in the lecture tonight.
Now, you've been connected with the book on Philippians. Is that right? Is that out already?
It is. It's a book called Dwelling with Philippians.
And you were one of two or three authors?
That's right. We had a group of four of us who were primary editors and actually another group of people that also worked with us in putting the book together. It's a very unusual commentary on the book of Philippians, which includes not only information on the historical setting of the book, but it's primarily actually a presentation of hymn poems and artistic images that provide a window into the theme of the text. Historical and literary commentaries are indispensable, but sometimes they don't capture the ethos of the text, or the affect of the text. And the work of visual artists and hymn poets and others is especially important for that. So for any group that's looking to study the book of Philippians, or for any pastor that's looking to preach in the book of Philippians, we think that this rather unorthodox or new kind of commentary has a lot of potential.
Now, who are the other authors?
Right. Grateful to be in partnership on that volume with Elizabeth Steele Halstead, member of our staff at the Worship Institute, Joyce Borger, who's editor of a journal, Reformed Worship, and Paul Detterman, a Presbyterian pastor with a lot of gifts in music and the arts.
And who published this?
That is published by Erdmann's. and has been out now just a few months, but we're grateful already is in a second printing. So it's
now,
been well
all
received.
The publishing companies in Grand Rapids, do they all have roots in the Dutch Reformed or Christian Reformed?
Many of them do. There is a deep love of books and of learning that runs through the Reformed tradition. And that I think has a lot to do with the fact that whether it's Zondervan, Kregel, Baker, or Erdmans, all of them in one way or another have been shaped by the ethos of Western Michigan and the love of learning.
Erdmans
there.
Is Dutch, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah. I don't think Baker's is.
Well, it's got a pretty strong connection, though, still.
And
yeah.
Zondervan?
Yeah. So.
When I lived in Michigan for several years in a row, along with some friends, we drove to Grand Rapids for the post-Christmas sale.
Oh, yes, yes.
Which and the bargains were tremendous. And you start with a shopping cart.
That's
you
right.
Start down the aisles. And if you go early enough, you could do Kregel's as well. You could do all four companies in one day.
That's a big day.
And come home with your treasures.
For book lovers, that's it's hard to beat a day like that in Grand Rapids.
One person that I wish I could have known better and longer was Robert Weber. We had him out here at Pepperdine one time, and I have loved his books. And you did something with him, and I forgot now what it is. What's
right.
your connection with Weber?
Two interesting points of connection. The primary one had to do with the large project that he edited called the Complete Library of Christian Worship. He had been a speaker at this conference that we hosted at Calvin and enjoyed getting to know him some. Quite tragically, one summer, the primary project editor on this large 7-volume work passed away very suddenly and unexpectedly. He was the visionary behind the project. Providentially for me, it was the time in my life in grad school where I was looking for summer work, and he called and asked if I would be a project editor for the last 4 volumes. And so I took on that challenge, and it helped pay the rent, but it really was like a second graduate degree in liturgical studies, because Weber had contacts throughout the evangelical world, a world that's often underrepresented in liturgical studies until recently. So we learned a lot and enjoyed that work together. And we also had a chance to work on a hymnal several years ago. And he also started graduate programs at a number of institutions, including Tyndale Seminary in Chicago, Northern Baptist Seminary in Chicago, in Toronto, Northern Baptist in Chicago, and the Institute of Worship Studies in Florida. And I've had some connections with all three of those over the years.
Yeah. If I was to look through your list of chapters and all these books and your monographs and so on, which one would you most want to be judged by? Which one would you say, read that article or read that portion of that book, and that would probably be the clearest introduction to who I am and what I try to achieve in my book. Which one are you most pleased with?
That's a very difficult
question. That is a tough one.
to answer.
You didn't know that one was coming.
I didn't know. I suppose that I might point to an essay I had the opportunity to work on a few years back on pedagogy and worship, the teaching of worship. I was very grateful to be a part of a group led by Dorothy Bass and Craig Dykstra on theological education and the practice of ministry. And many of our conversations in this group of scholars, very ecumenical group, we each represented very different institutions, the focus was really on effective teaching. The underlying premise of the group was that there is a lot of teaching in divinity schools, seminaries, and theological and religious studies in general, which does not really equip people for service in the church or is designed to serve other ends. It might be very legitimate pursuits, but it does not really support the formation of leaders for Christian communities. So I had a chance to work on an essay on pedagogy, and really it's in one's pedagogy. It's in the choice of materials and the choice of how that material is introduced that one's own implicit theology is revealed, one's implicit priorities are revealed. We often take with us large assumptions that come through our own formation that we simply replicate without reflection. Rather surprisingly, I find myself thinking a great deal recently about the process of pedagogy, which really is the larger theme of formation that's so important in parenting, mm-hmm. in church life as a whole, but also needs a lot of attention in a university context.
Now, when you're back home in Grand Rapids, where is home church? And are you a worship of minister? Do you lead singing or are you?
On most Sunday mornings back home, I'm a member of a congregation and I'm grateful to be a member of Church of the Servant, Christian Reformed Church in Grand Rapids. Wonderful community. Worship has been a very important element of Church of the Servant for many years. In many ways, it was founded to explore the world of worship renewal in the late 60s and 70s and reflects a lot of attention to ecumenical learning about worship, but also is deeply committed to a lot of social justice ministries and as well as prayer and evangelism. So it's a holistic vision behind the church. But after working as a staff member or worship leader in several congregations, I'm grateful that, especially given the pressing demands of my work at Calvin, to on Sunday morning be able to sit with my family as a member of the congregation without those extra responsibilities.
Now, are you musically gifted in being able to play several instruments?
I play a few instruments at a very basic amateurish level that's probably best not happening in front of people. I do have a graduate degree in choral conducting, and my undergraduate degree is in vocal performance as a singer. So I've been grateful to for eight of my now 14 years at Calvin College to have been a conductor of a large choir. And that was a group that focused on worship-related music. So I'm still very active in thinking about music for worship and editing and selecting and recommending materials for congregations to use. The schedule doesn't allow me to continue with the large choir as it once did, and I miss it very much. Yeah. But I'm grateful for the continued work in music on a really daily basis.
Now, does your wife share all that love for music?
She does. She is an undergraduate piano performance major. And for me, I was always grateful to have a good accompanist as I was an undergraduate singer. And we developed a close friendship. And she chose to pursue psychology, clinical psychology, as her area of specialty. So music for us now is more a hobby than a part of our primary vocation. But it's a wonderful love that we share.
Did you sing in the chorus when you were at Calvin College?
I did, yes.
And did she?
She did.
And did you meet at
the... We did, absolutely.
Is that where you met?
Absolutely. Yeah, and there's been some joy later on when I conducted the very same choir that we met in to have a few students find each other there too.
Yeah.
So there's something about choir... choir touring and all of that yeah. allows for forming deep friendships.
I've forgotten what you spoke on when you were here this summer. You came to the Ascending Voice
That's right.
Symposium, the International Symposium on Acapella Music. What
That's
was
right.
your lecture there?
I focused there on singing the Psalms and on ways that the scholarship of the biblical poetry might challenge us to think of new ways of singing the Psalms. Mm. There are so many ways in which the study of the poetry of the Psalter has advanced in the last 100 years, new questions and new insights. But yet the ways we've gone about singing the Psalms have not always reflected that learning. So the talk I gave was really a talk that imagined what new kinds of questions we might ask. If one of the insights of Psalm scholarship is that rather than seeing a typical psalm as a collection of discrete units that need to be divided, we ought to see the shape of each individual psalm as reflecting a significant journey from the beginning to the end of the psalm. But yet, we often have musical settings of the psalm that remain rather static. They begin with a certain sound, whether melody, harmony, rhythm, that's largely constant throughout the psalm. The music then doesn't always move us from one place to another. Mm-hmm. What would it be like if we really listened to these literary scholars and asked the question, how could our music lead us on the same journey that the psalm takes? That's an example. There are several other questions like it.
Pepperdine is affiliated with Churches of Christ. George Pepperdine was an elder in the Church of Christ. Was this summer your first time to connect with Churches of Christ, coming to that conference?
I was grateful to be a guest at the college, Church of Christ College in Abilene, Texas, several years ago.
Oh, were you?
And we've also, in our office, been grateful to have a relationship with Church of Christ College in Rochester, Michigan. We've been able to award a grant related to worship renewal to them. So I've had these encounters before, but am grateful to have these contacts. And I do think my visit here on Sunday to be a part of the University Church probably was my first opportunity to be in a Sunday service of a congregation and to experience unaccompanied singing. We were grateful to be here.
Well, we're very glad to have you on campus today and look forward to hearing your lecture tonight in this Frank Pack series. And we hope you'll keep coming back. You're here until you go back in June, is
that
right?
That's right.
And this is only January.
We've just begun.
So we hope you'll be back on campus several times.
All right. Thanks, Jerry.
It's good to be with you. Come back.
Thank you.